Good morning. Good afternoon. It all comes together very organically. Definitely wildflower. It comes together when we trust that it will. That it's all right, whatever it is. When we trust that collectively and also individually. And everyone is willing to put aside their ideas about how it should be, who should do what, when it should be done, how it should look, the result. And then it's absolutely wondrous. Like wildflowers. So we have we welcome the two new arrivals, Dale and Elliot. It seems like we've been here for a long time already. We haven't even been here for 12 hours probably. Yes, 12 hours, but yeah. And then the group changes as new people arrive. And that's also organic. So I mentioned last night during our casual conversation over dinner, this notion of, in traditional Zen, when they talk about submission and surrender, and how I prefer to, let's say, my experience is, it's not even a preference, it's what my experience is that the, what we can call our true self, our true nature, when it awakens, rebels against the status quo of the oppressive identity that we're attached to and that limits us and keeps us from moving freely and acting with care, not doing harm. And it's so instead of having to surrender and submit in order to become free, it's we wake up and then overthrow the regime within ourselves, it's oppressing ourselves. It's, you know, I think probably the result, in the traditional way of phrasing it, of surrender and submission, is aiming for the same, is taking us down the same road. It's just a different formulation, and it comes from cultural and social differences in traditional Japanese culture, let's say. Whereas maybe, you know, maybe the American in me is more, and also living in France, it's more revolutionary, something like that. And then my own experience is not one of submission or surrender, it's one of waking up and overthrowing. And so when we briefly mentioned that last night, I was thinking about it since then and how that ties in with this retreat that will culminate on Sunday morning with Adrien's Jukai. And had Adrien not come, I don't know if we would have talked about this, but it would have been something else, right? It's organic, so we respond to the situations. But he came, so that's what we're talking about. Or I might have, because last night, responding to a question, this subject came up, that subject was with me, and I might have addressed it in a different way this morning had we not been projecting towards the Jukai on Sunday. But because we are, Jukai is Japanese for receiving the precepts, we say, generally, that's how it's translated. But we don't actually receive anything. Nothing is transmitted. What we do simply is acknowledge that this way, the precepts are just indications of the enlightened way of living, of the way of doing no harm, of doing good for oneself and of doing good for others. Those are the, you know, the three basic pure precepts. And this path that is set out before us with these precepts is just where we are acknowledging that that is who we are, that that is ourselves. That's our enlightened way. That's the enlightened I expressing itself through those precepts. And we, when we say we want to express formally that that is our way, that's really important for our practice. It's not important for achieving some kind of special status or getting some kind of special piece of cloth that you actually make yourself, which is crucial as well, because it's not coming from anyone else. It's coming from you. You do it. There are some lineages, there are some schools, traditions where you order the rakusu online. Or you buy it in a shop. Or maybe there is someone in the Sangha who makes rakusus for people. Then after our first rakusu, then other people do make rakusus for us, right? So someone made this one for me, someone made that one for Joa. But we each made our own the first time. Because it's about our way, our realization. Acknowledging, this is me. This is how I choose to live my life. When we talk about this, we say receiving the precepts that's what Jukai literally means, but it also means, you know, so there's all kinds of different translations and versions of it. And I like Maizumi Roshi's version, which I've often used. And oddly enough, when I was coming here, you know, I asked Adrien, should I bring my stuff, all of my equipment and things for the Jukai, because he wasn't sure if he was coming or not. So I gathered everything together just in case. So if he said yes, I could just grab the bag, put it in the car, and we'd come. And I could not find, I have a folder that has the Jukai ceremony in it and has all these notes that I've taken throughout the years about Jukai, which I bring with me, and then I can kind of look at it and refresh my memory if I'm going to talk about it or whatever. I have no idea where that folder is. Which is good, you know. That's a really good thing that I had to forget it all, you know. Couldn't rely on anything. So, fortunately, I have the ceremony in my computer and I can print it out, so at least I had the ceremony that I could follow along with, right? But I can't find any of these precious notes that I've been taking since, well, the first time I, as a teacher, transmitted and gave Jukai was in 2008. So I've been making these notes all these years, and I don't know where they are. They must be somewhere, because I would not have thrown them away. So I just had to kind of review and grabbed one of Maizumi Roshi's books just so I could kind of remember. It's not actually the one that he says very much about Jukai in. So I even took the wrong book, which is fine, because then it's more organic and fresh and true, you know. So basically, Ju, when we break it down, J-U, is to realize, and Kai, K-A-I, usually is lightly translated as the precepts, but another level of it is Buddha nature or true nature. So Jukai means to realize Buddha nature, realize your true nature. That's the That's my Zumi Roshi's take on it. And he says, and this is a quote from him, to truly receive the precepts is in itself to realize your true nature. So just the very act of doing it is you are, at that moment, realizing who you truly are, your true nature, your original face, all these things that we say, true nature, Buddha nature, before a thought of good and evil, who are you really, all these traditional Zen jargon that we use. So that's at the same time, it's a very beautiful, simple, basic way of looking at it, but it's, you know, like de Gaulle said when somebody said, cried out to him, "Mort au con," and he said back, "Vaste programme, monsieur." So this is a vast program, right, we've set up for ourselves. Apparently he was really funny, de Gaulle, everybody says. He had this really good sense of humor. Unlike Nicolas Sarkozy, and, you know, very different. Because what didn't Sarkozy say when somebody like, was like, "Dégage, con," or something? Right. Very different temperaments. Different level of sophistication. Anyway, so this is, you know, a vast program, and it's also really simple. You know, it's just be here now, who you truly are. Which, you know, so first we have to look at, okay, so who am I truly? You know, what does that mean? You know, we have all this stuff going on. That keeps us, you know, so it comes back to this thing of the true self that revolts against all this other stuff that we project onto ourselves, that other people project onto us, and we believe. You know, I watch my 4-month-old grandson he doesn't have any of this stuff, you know, he doesn't know anything about anybody or anything. He's like learning it all. And he's learning it, you know, and so if people tell him, "Oh, you're so cute, you're so sweet, that's great what you do," then he's happy. But if somebody, for the moment, nobody is telling him, "You're terrible, you shouldn't do that." But at some point, somebody probably will, and then he'll take that out too. For the moment, you know, he has a really good mommy who's like, "Oh, you're so cute and great," and but at some point, we need other stuff. And then we take that on. And this is another identity, and another identity, and another identity. We have to make these differentiations. We have to gain a sense of self as a baby, because otherwise we remain in this illusion that we are not separate from our mother, when in fact we are. So we have to make that step and realize it. But the problem is that then we forget, as we grow older, we see only that. We see only that separation, only those distinctions. And we don't see what we truly share. We miss who we truly are. So yeah, I made some of these notes because I didn't have any others. So just to be sure I don't lose track of what I'm trying to say here. So yeah. And there's different, so there's this interesting thing that, I think this was in Mizumi Roshi's book, or I don't know where I saw this, but the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, who said, "I on its own is an abstraction."
Abstraction?
I on its own is an abstraction.
Abstraction.
Concrete fact is I, you, or I, it. So it's this I that we're always talking about, it's really abstract. But we realize, when we can realize it, when we realize that it's me, that I am it. I am you, I am that, like my Dharma name is. This can sound confusing, because it sounds like, okay, so wait, I'm not it, But now you're saying I am it. So which I are we talking about? And we have this great koan of from the Mumin Khan, case number 12. Zwigin calls master. So there's this great master, Zwigin, who used to call out to himself, "Master, are you in?" And he would answer himself, "Yes, I am." Zwigin would then ask further, "Are you awake?" And then Zwigin would answer himself, "Yes, I am." Then Zwigin says, "Do not be deceived by others day or night." As Zwigin replies, "No, I won't." And so what is this? So Zwigin is saying, "Master, are you awake?" And he's answering, "Yes, I am." This sounds like, you know, some kind of schizophrenic thing, right? Multiple personalities or whatever. Well, it is to not in a, you know, deeply psychologically deranged, problematic way, but it does cause us a lot of problems when we don't see that master. And we forget the master being your true self, who you truly are. And so Zwigin does, you know, he called out to himself every day, "Are you in?" And then that would remind him to connect with who he truly is. "Yes, I am in. Are you awake?" "Yes, I am awake." Do not be deceived by the others. So usually we think the others are out there. It's everybody else's fault, right? But actually the others are here. So the others that we're being deceived by are here. And he's reminding himself, okay, no, I will not be deceived by these others. I will stay true to who I truly am. And that's not easy, you know, because there's so many other voices, so many other things we're thinking, oh, what should I do in this situation? I even talked about it the other night, on Monday night, about Dogen's three minds. So Dogen, in his instructions to the cook, he talks about these three minds that is necessary for a cook. I don't know, was anybody, you were there on Monday night.
I don't remember this, so, okay.
Right. And nobody else was there, so I'm not repeating myself for anybody else. So, you know, he said there's a joyful mind, which is necessary. Elder mind, which is also sometimes called grandmotherly or parental or nurturing mind. And then great or big or magnanimous mind. So these are these three minds. And that too can sound like kind of, uh-oh, so which one am I supposed to be dealing with here? You know? The fact is they're all present if we do not become attached to one or the other and become identified with one or the other. They're all present all the time. So in Dogen's formulation, joyful is, I'll just kind of summarize it, is to find appreciation and joy for what you're doing. So, and we often give the example, it's in the kitchen he's talking about. So it's, you know, find great joy in putting things in their proper place, or find great joy in cutting the onions just like this, or sharpening the knife, or joy in washing the lettuce, whatever it is. Just take pleasure, joy in whatever it is you're doing without having an idea about this is good, this is bad, I don't like this, I do like this, why do I have to do this and not somebody else? I want to get to the fun part where I add the spices. Just taking joy in just this. Then the nurturing and the elder grandmotherly kind mind is one that every act is done with extreme care, as if it was taking care of your child, your only child. It's like we say in the Orioki of when you feed yourself with the spoon, you know, it's as if you're feeding a child. You do it with great care and great love and nurturing. It doesn't. It's not always kind in what we think of as being kind. Sometimes we say grandmotherly compassion can be cutting through the delusion. It can be strict. But it's done with this deep care and love for whatever the is needed, you know? So it can be, like I think I said on Monday, it can be correcting someone and saying, no, don't cut the onions that way. Or, no, don't peel the apples. So, you know, last night when we were all preparing the fruit, and Claudia said, don't peel the apples, because we all just enthusiastically started peeling the apples, you know? And it was not said with the mind of, you're wrong, that's bad, you're not good, do it my way. It was just said, this is, you know, these apples are organic, we wash them, we can keep the skin on. There's not an attachment to self when this grandmotherly nurturing mind is present. It's just responding to the situation with this we're not yet to the magnanimous, but it still is magnanimous heart. It's coming from this place of care. And then the great, his third mind that needs to be present is the great, big, magnanimous mind, which sees the big picture, which is able to not be fixed on any position or any place or any idea, which opens to it all. And within that, the other two can function freely. This is the mind that we could say, you know, stands above, but it's not above. It just has a wide, it's like a drone view or something, you know, of the vast panoramic awareness, that's Shogyam Trungpa called it. And all of these three minds, and of course then you could break it down into other kinds of minds too, but those are what Dogen pointed out. Now, when we talk about these others in ourselves, it can be those minds, but it usually is, and it can also be the, you know, the voice of judgment about others, the judgment about self. It can also be the voice of grasping, wanting that, wanting this, wanting that person, wanting an image to be projected, wanting people to love me, wanting to stick to my idea of what is good and what is bad, wanting to make others, we say these in the precepts, you know, wanting to, I vow to refrain from belittling others and raising myself up. So that's a voice that's in us too, that voice. Or always wanting to be the savior, or never wanting to do anything for anyone. There's all these different voices that are happening in us. And the true self, who we truly are, is none of that. Of course, all of that is included in who we are. But our true identity, if you will, which is not an identity, our true nature, which is no nature, is none of that. Is not fixed, is not attached to any of those. And when we, so then when we take this step to receive the precepts, we are acknowledging that. We may not experience that at every moment. We may only, it may still be kind of this flickering thing that we say, okay, yeah, I hear what that is, I recognize that, but I'm not really in, so in contact with it. Well, entering this path, by receiving the precepts, we are saying, yes, I acknowledge it, and I'm going to follow that path to realize who I truly am. Maizumi Roshi said that with this thing, I think it's Genpo or someone who told me this story, maybe Geno Roshi, I don't know, that Maizumi Roshi, when he was a child, his father was a Zen master and had his family had a temple, and his brothers also, they all practiced Zen, and when he was young, I don't know how young, his father used to talk about this koan. He would say this koan to his kids, to his boys. And then he would say to them, Who are the others? Or where are the others? Do not be deceived by others. And he would ask his boys, who are the others? So already these little boys, these young men, I don't know if they were teenagers, whatever, were paying attention to this. I was not paying attention to this when I was a teenager at all. I think all of us have some, as children and at different moments, different experiences of this. That's not me. Or is that really me? Or a moment when everything just feels right within ourselves. But we don't really dwell on it. We don't spend much time on it because no one, like Mizumi's father, is saying, who are you? What is that? No one's saying that to us, most of us, you know. I know myself that I did have those kinds of moments. And as I became a teenager, that became even more present. But because nobody was paying any attention to it and there was all kinds of other attractions, I didn't go that way. Although, I never actually left. You know, when I say I didn't go that way, I was always here. I came to realize that. Even as a teenager, I wrote a poem, and the first line of the poem was, having never left, I'm back again. Which I totally got on some level when I was a teenager. It was only much, 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 much later. And even now, it's a koan for me. Having never left, I'm back again. We don't actually ever leave. And yet, we think that we're so far away and we get caught up in all this stuff. But we don't actually ever leave. You're always who you truly are. Don't always realize it. We don't always pay attention to it. But you always are. You can't be anyone else. That's the good news and the bad news, as we say. No, you can't be anyone else. So I wrote down the verse that, so in the Mumenkan there's always a koan, and then there's a verse that goes with it that was written by Mumen, and then there's the person who compiled the collection, and then there's a comment on the koan, and then there's a comment on the verse, and then whoever is, has the written this, who's ever brought Mumen's stuff together in a new collection has comments on Mumen's comments and Mumen's verse and the case. So it's kind of like a mise en abîme, as we say. But so I just copied the koan, the case, and Mumen's verse. So the reason those who learn the way don't realize the truth is simply that they perceive the discriminating consciousness they've had all along. It is the origin of endless life and death. Fools take it for the essential self. So basically he's saying the reason that we don't realize the truth of who we are is because we're fixed on this discriminating consciousness, which is cutting, separating, judging. And that leads us to the endless, you know, what in traditional Buddhism is called samsara, the endless cycle, repetitive thing of life and death, being attached to life and attached to death. And he says, fools take it for the essential self. Fools, he's not saying you're bad if you do, but he's just saying you don't realize it. You think that is the essential self, but in fact the essential self, your true self, is not that. And not all that discriminating stuff that's going on. As Mumen probably said, I didn't read his commentary, but he probably said, you have to meet the master face to face. So in Zwiegen's thing, Zwiegen is constantly reminding himself the master and meeting the master face to face. And when you meet the master face to face, the true self face to face, then there is no master and there is no I. There's no you. You're one. It's like the you know, the famous myth of Narcissus, who sees his reflection in the water and is so in love with his reflection that he falls into the water. And I forget how the traditional interpretation is. My personal interpretation, and I think this might have come from Joyce, from James Joyce, is that when he looks in the water, he sees his true face. I think in the traditional Greek, he you know, falls in the water and dies or something. Yeah, I think that's it, yeah. Well, in this, my interpretation, which is a Zen interpretation, and I think was also Joyce's interpretation, is that he sees his true face, and therefore the deluded separate self dies. He awakens to the oneness of who he truly is, of his true self, when he sees the reflection of himself in the water. He comes face to face with the master of his true self, and then there is no separation anymore. So that's what the precepts are pointing us towards. You know, we talk about the different, maybe tomorrow we can talk about that, the different, the three different ways of looking at the precepts. The literal, the subjective, and the intrinsic. So, you know, the literal is do not kill. So nothing should be killed. So that goes really far. We constantly are violating that precept because just by being alive, we're killing cells in our body so that they can regenerate and then live. We're walking on all kinds of organisms and killing them as we walk. We have to kill plants, at least plants, to eat so we can survive. So there's always some kind of killing going on. But that the literal interpretation of that is do not kill, do not steal, do not lie, literal interpretation. Then the subjective, or the intrinsic, let's say the intrinsic position, way of looking at it, is that, and that's the oneness point of view, that there is no killing, there is no I, there is no you, there is no other, there is no possessions, there's nothing to steal, there's nothing to possess. That's the oneness point of view. And then the subjective point of view is, it depends. So in one situation, it may be okay to lie. And we give the example of if the Gestapo knocks at your door and you're hiding Jews in your basement and says, Are you hiding Jews here? You will say no. You will lie, you know. Probably. If you don't, well, then you're violating another precept because they're probably going to die and you might too, you know. So, you're sacrificing their life for some other precept that says don't lie. So see, if we stick to them literally, we then can violate them as well, and we miss the greater picture. If we only see them from the intrinsic point of view, well, then anything goes, right? We wouldn't even bother hiding the Jews in our basement because it doesn't matter. There's nobody to die. There's nobody to kill. There's no... It's all good, you know? Nothing. The trick is that all three of those points of view are happening at the same time. Like all three of those minds, Dogen's minds, are all present at the same time. all these others in you are present at the same time. And if we fix to any one of them, we become lost and probably do harm. So precepts, same thing. You know, if we, you know, another literary example of Jean Valjean in Miserables, who steals bread because his family is starving. You know, there's people starving and he steals a loaf of bread. Well, and then endless travails. 3 volumes, or how many volumes are in Miserables? I don't know. You know, Broadway musicals. you know, all these amazing things come from that stealing of that one loaf of bread. But the point of stealing the loaf of bread was not to take something that was not his. It was to do good, to feed somebody else who was hungry, you know. It's all, it's true, we don't steal. That's, you know, we don't, anytime we take what is not ours, we are in a completely deluded space, thinking that I can possess something. When we say there is no other and there is no possession, I can take whatever I want, that's also deluded. You know, there's Bernie Glassman's famous quote when someone asked him, saw that he had this old beat-up car, kind of like the car that my husband's car, you know. Someone said to him, wow, wouldn't you like to have a nice car? You know, wouldn't you like to have a Porsche? And he said, oh, yeah, but I do have a Porsche. I have a lot of Porsches. Down the avenue, there's a Porsche dealership. Those are all mine. that's the oneness point of view. It's all mine. It's all me. And in that case, I can be perfectly happy with what I have. With the 30-year-old Peugeot 306 that, you know, pollutes probably just tragically, but okay, you know, we're making a choice here, so. There is a way of, so from Bernie's, when Bernie says that, then he doesn't need to even consider stealing because it's already his, the Porsche. He doesn't need to have anything else because it's all his and he can appreciate what is. He is the other. He is the owner of the Porsche. He is the one who makes the Porsche. He's the one who sells the Porsche. There's nothing, he doesn't need to steal. He doesn't need to lie. He doesn't need to kill. So when we see this, when we realize who our true self is, then the precepts become clear in a different way. Oh yeah, of course. That's what I want. And even if we don't realize who we truly are and we receive the precepts, we realize that it's a roadmap for us to realize us who we truly are, to come to that realization. I don't want to steal. I don't want to lie. I don't want to engage in sexual misconduct. I don't want to cloud my mind with whether it's substances, whether it's ideas, whether it's positions. I don't want to. It's my choice. It's not like someone is saying, this is not the Ten Commandments coming down from God, you know. And then Moses carrying it to you and saying, you have to do this. No, this is like, this is the true self saying, this is what I want. This is how I choose to live. Not because someone tells me to live that way. And that's the great power of our practice. It's not because someone is telling you to do it that you do it. You do it because you want to. And so Zwiegen, when he says, are you awake? Yes. Don't be deceived by others. I won't. Because I don't want to be. I'm not, I'm I'm not going to listen to those other voices in me that are saying, oh yeah, you should actually today, you know, it's a holiday today, it's Friday, you should be out partying at the beach or something. This is where I want to be. This is where I choose to be. And sometimes the choices, you know, Adrienne had a different choice to make. It wasn't about going to party at the beach. It was about whether to stay with Luciana or not. Different choices, but we have the, and it, so it's not always this beautiful thing that we want to choose instead of coming here or whatever it is, you know. And there's all these voices telling us to do these different things. And all these positions that we take, these different minds, but what is the true mind? Who is the true you? So does anyone have any questions or anything while I fresh up with my notes? Yeah.
What's the idea of getting a new name when you
someone? A Dharma name, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, that is part of it. So when we receive the precepts, I'm assuming you received a name. Yeah. So when we do this, and so we received the rakusu that we made, at least in our lineage. I don't know. Did you make yours? No. Okay. See, so some schools, they don't. They don't make their own
rakusu.
What?
Some do, some don't.
Right. Okay. You have the choice. Yeah. And so we have this rakusu, and the teacher writes something on the back of it, and we receive the blood lineage chart, which, as I told Adelina, I forgot to give to him the last time I saw him. So either he will do it here while he's here, or he'll do it at a later moment. It's a blood lineage chart that starts with, you know, Buddha at the top and then goes all the way down through all the 83 generations. And with all the names, and you have to write them all on the chart. And it's similar to one of the charts that we receive in when we receive the Dharma transmission. We have three charts in the Dharma transmission, but this one is very similar to that. The blood lineage, and actually it's a circle because it gets all the way down to the bottom and then it goes back up to the top, to Shakyamuni. So it's a circle, which basically means that each of us, you are Shakyamuni Buddha. You are the teacher before you, and the teacher before that, and the teacher before that, and Shakyamuni Buddha is you. It's just a circle. We are all it. And it's endless. So we get the rakusu, we get the chart, and we receive a name. The teacher gives us a Dharma name, as you many of you know here. And on the rakusu is written whatever the teacher has chosen to write. And for the first rakusu, we all have the same thing, the verse of the kesa. And then after, with the later rakusus, we have other things that our teacher chooses to write or not. And you have your Dharma name on it and the teacher's stamp. So the Dharma name is, now maybe in the Pacific Zen Institute you have a different approach to the Dharma name. So I'm just telling you what ours is. It's as if we, because we are acknowledging who we truly are in this process, this ceremony, we're publicly going before the Sangha and saying, this is my way. And receiving these precepts, the teacher gives a Dharma name that points to that nature, that points to that true nature of who you truly are. And at least what I try to do and what I know my teacher does, and I don't know about her teacher because I never heard him talk about it, but I know that's what she does, so probably her teacher did that too, I sit... You know, I sit with the person as if it's a koan. And then I, and because I know the person, having, you know, I work with the person usually. I mean, always I work with the person, yeah. This, in traditional Japanese society, that's not how it works. You can go and receive jukai with, you know, like 100 people receive jukai all at once, and receive a dharma name and a rakusu and everything. But ours are very personalized because we have a personal relationship with our students. So I sit as if it's a koan, and then what comes up for me is at once what my sense of who the person truly is, of who they truly are, and what their way truly is. And also, that way is, they haven't fully realized it. So if they can it's a pointer towards where they can go. Because they already are that, and yet it can be endlessly realized. So, like my example is, my dharma name is Chue Sura. You are that. My teacher gave me this name because I already knew that, and she knew that I knew that, but I had to continue realizing it, deepening it, widening it. And I still do. You know, it's my personal koan, which is also, and it's also becomes a teaching device, because it's something that I can pull out of my pocket, you know, from behind my rakusu, and remind you of that, that it's not, that's my dharma name, which is actually talking to you. You are that. It's not I am that, it's you are that. So, and it's an endless koan, and I think that for all of you, it's the case too, no? I mean, the dharma names I gave, I didn't give Joe his dharma name, because he did Chukai with Gennaro Roshi. However, I gave everyone else your dharma names. And for each of you, it was exactly like I just described. That was how I came to that name. Now, in our... Is yours a Japanese name? Or is it in English?
English.
Yeah, okay. So, modern teachers now, we're starting to do that, you know, so like...
It's actually both.
It's both.
It's written in kanji, and it's written in English.
So that's another variation, right? My teacher, her teacher, gave all of his students, and still does, Japanese names. And he usually will tell them what the meaning is, I think, in English. She decided that because she doesn't speak Japanese, none of her students speak Japanese, that she would give the names either in French or in English. So all of us, her students have French, many of us have French names, but those who don't speak French have English names. And I have chosen to do the same thing. So I give the names in English. And usually, or French, whichever people want, but usually there is an equivalent in Japanese if somebody wanted to look for it. I don't choose to go there, but usually there is, because these come out of the traditional teachings, these names and these phrases and everything that we use. I just saw the other day reading something, I forget what it was, something, where I saw Debbie's name and they gave the Japanese equivalent to it, which I had no idea was an official Japanese name. So you could probably find that if you wanted to. You know, if I can remember where I saw it, I'll tell you. Yeah. And Claudia's, we know, because when I gave her the name, I said it came from Dogen's Bendova, which is wholehearted way, but I chose, or true way, and I chose true way instead of wholehearted, because wholehearted, true seemed more direct. Original face, Aras, that's traditional thing. Man of the way, Freddie, is same thing. You know, we have koans about that. So every, you know, all the Joas, Saruiki Sov, you know, that's like Avalokiteshvara or something. So there are traditional things we can use. Mine is an ancient, ancient pre-Buddhist, you know, Upanishad name, Sanskrit.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah. So, that's my take on it. So what's your name, your Dharma name, now that we've...
Way of Dreaming.
Wow.
Ah,
wow.
This is a very ancient kanji.
Wow.
This is way, this is dreaming.
Oh, wow.
You see the eye, kind of an eye, and this is a night, like night.
Oh,
dreaming,
wow.
Way of dreaming, and then it's just written here, way of dreaming.
And what's the verse that's written on
verse
there?
Verse is... It's from I think the Ekikanoku 12.
Oh, okay. Is it different on everyone's, or is it
Different, and that's very similar process where you're working with the teacher on precepts, and you work, and the name comes out, and you're working together, and the teacher gives the name, and but it's kind of similar, very personalized. And if you expressed it well, it's kind of reaching forward in terms of...
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah,
interesting. Okay, so that's another version. And we actually have, you know, we were talking, Jeff, that... So his teacher, John Tarrant, is a student of... received transmission from Eiken Roshi. And Eiken Roshi and Maizumi Roshi were linked. And Eiken Roshi, because he was a lay teacher... At one point, he asked Maizumi Roshi to give his students Jukai because he was not authorized to do so. But then I think Maizumi Roshi told him, forget it, just do it or something. I don't know. Or maybe Maizumi Roshi gave him or something. Do you know the story of that? Do you know anything about that? No. Okay.
Yeah, my teacher's not actually John Terrence, a teacher. Tesbisi is also a teacher.
Okay. It's not actually him. Okay.
Yeah.
But he's a student of John Terrence.
She,
okay. So, see, we're all kind of coming from different branches of the same tree, as it were. And then in the West, you know, we're doing it different ways, but pointing to the same thing, pointing to this true self, pointing to this way of, this way that we share. And it... You know, it transcends all of the forms and the rituals and the expressions. The truth of it, you know, the absolute truth of it is one, no matter how it's expressed. And it can't be. You know, it cannot be learned in a book. It cannot be taught in a class. I recently saw this quote by Confucius that said, tell me, I forget. Show me, I remember. Involve me, I understand. And this was referring to, like, learning. Process of learning. And we can, you know, we know that. You know, if somebody tells you how to do something, you know, if somebody, like, or if you watch a video of a recipe, because we were talking about this yesterday, so you watch the video of the recipe, well, or you just read it in the book, well, you forget. And you have to look at it again and again and again. Sometimes, even when you've done it, you have to look at it again and again and again. But it's very different that. Or then somebody, so yeah, tell me, it would, somebody would say to you, oh yeah, this is how you make it. Show me would be, they would show you how they're making it. Involving you is you actually making it. You actually doing it. And that's the beauty of our practice, is that that's what it's about. It's you actually realizing it. It's not, I'm sitting here telling you all this stuff, and we're all talking about things, but that's not really all what it's about. It's outside of it, you know, outside of the books, outside of the talks, outside of everything, the best true sermon is lived here and now by you. And that's what the whole path of the precepts is about. It's realizing that. Really, how best to live your life fully, completely, freely. Not somebody else's life, not the way someone else wants you to live it, not how society wants you to live it. Already, you know, like I always say, this is subversive what we're doing here. This is really radical and subversive in our current culture. Of it's non-utilitarian, it's not involved with expanding our profile, not, you know, projecting an image of what our life looks like or who we would like to be. It's not engaged in disputes and violence. It's not involved with accumulating, whether it's fame or possessions or money. It's so radical what we do. We just sit here. Yeah.
I was going to say, it's also super cheap. Yeah. And then I thought, oh, yeah, and it's made in China. Oh, but it is made in China.
That's true. That's true.
Made in China.
But actually, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the U.S., the cheap stuff was made in Japan.
Yeah.
And anyone of my age, I don't know, but cheap stuff was made in Japan. And then suddenly, somewhere it became made in China. But both are true. I mean, essentially, yes, it's free. It's just you. You just sit down, you know, and anyone, anywhere, anytime can realize who they truly are. Of course, you know, we do have to get here, so we have to pay for our transport one way or the other, and then we have to cover the costs of food, use of electricity and gas and water and upkeep in the house. So we do pay something, but that's not what it's about. You know, nobody, if you want to, I suppose there are some Zen teachers who make a lot of money, but not many. Well, we talked about one last night, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We did talk about one last night who makes a lot of money. But, you know, if you want to make money, then go into some other business, you know. And, yeah, it's free. Free for the taking. Whoever, I never turn anyone away. Unless, you know, I do, if people have psychological problems, deep psychiatric issues, I don't recommend meditation. And I will tell them that they should not do this, they should go to something else. But otherwise, I can't really think of what...
Sorry, why is that?
Well, you know, you have to have a really, depending on their profile, you have to have a really sound sense of self in order to let go of self, you know. Mm. And you have to be grounded, more or less, in order to enter this emptiness, space of emptiness, you know, where you have nothing to hang on to. So it depends, you know, what the profile is, but it can, you know, there can be psychotic breaks and things with this practice. So, but it's, you know, it's accessible to everyone, children, old people, everything in between, no racial, cultural, national distinctions. No religious distinctions, you know, like we say, there's Zen practitioners who are rabbis, Zen practitioners who are priests, imams, businessmen, cleaning ladies, every, you know, one of the great ancestors that we all venerate, the sixth patriarch, was illiterate and was basically, you know, you call it a woodcutter, and had a deep realization and became one of the greatest teachers in our lineage, you know. don't have to be smart. You don't have to be dumb. You don't have to be funny. You don't have to wear special clothing. Anyone, anywhere, anytime. Super radical in our culture today. Really, really subversive. And yet, we say that the people who are fully realized, you don't even notice them. So ordinary. No? Nothing special, because that's what we realize. Nothing special. I know that, and it can even be, when we think special, it can even be like, it can be a super deep lack of self-confidence. And thinking that you're not worthy or you're not able to do it, and therefore you have to then make yourself look good or do something special. Usually, when we're trying to make ourselves special, it's coming from a place of not feeling special. So, all of those fall away. All of those ideas fall away when we see who we truly are. Extraordinarily special because nothing special, just like everybody else. And the precepts are a path leading us that way. So what time do we have here?
It's 1:17.
Okay. So maybe I will stop talking and
may I ask
questions? Yeah.
This is a memorabilia question. Who were your first Jukai people in 2008? Anybody we know?
Yeah, well, maybe. The very first one was Sarah Scott, an English woman. Joa was there.
Mm-hmm.
Freddie was there, I think. Freddie was there. It was in Mont-la-Jolie.
Okay. Oui.
Yeah.
Oui.
Yeah.
And you just did one person.
And you. She was a friend of Tanya and Simon's.
Okay.
Hard of hearing.
That doesn't sound ring bell. So am I.
So anyway, yes, she was the first one, and she had asked me to do Jukai before I had received transmission even.
Oh, she was on the screen during COVID.
Yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I see who she is.
So she was the first one, and that was in February 2008, and the next one was in Portugal in March of 2008. It was Margarita Cardoso, who was the one who was Joan Rodriguez's ex-girlfriend, who invited us to Portugal, Roshi and I, and helped us found Wildflower. I think you knew Margarita, no? Maybe not. Maybe she's gone by the time you came.
Yes.
I don't know if you knew
her. She came to Donna.
She did come to Donna once, yeah. With Joan. Yeah. And before Joan left for Japan and in those old days. She was the second one. She was the first one in Portugal, and Sarah was the first one in France.
Were you nervous? Or?
Yes. Especially with the first one.
This is quite
a... and Geno Roshi was there for the first one. She always comes for the first one. And she came, and some other people from Donna came. A lot of people. I don't remember who, but... And, the terrifying moment was having to write something on the Rakusu. Was to write for the first time on the Rakusu, because it's like, I'm going to ruin it, or I'm going to make a mistake, or... I think, Joa, you were probably my Jisha, so you were probably there when we were doing it, no?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So Geno Roshi was there, and Joa, and probably whoever Geno Roshi's Jisha was. And
I can't get it back.
No.
I mean, you can't erase it.
No. And I was kind of like, no. And again, she said to me, just do it, Amy. Just do it. And that's like kind of her thing that she used to say to me. Just do it, Amy.
And now you just did like the monk, threw away the diamond sutra, threw away your notes.
Wait, what? Say what?
That monk that threw away the diamond sutra, his comments. You remember? They called me the monk that throws away his notes on the diamond suit.
Yeah, yeah.
You yeah. did the same with your notes now.
Exactly. Exactly. Toku-san. Yeah. Toku-san, exactly. Exactly, yeah. Although I didn't do it intentionally. He did it with full intention. Burning all these notes, you know. So yes, but once I did that, and then of course I was nervous, and you know, then after I did it, Dhyana Roshi was like, "Oh, you made the same mistake that I made." There's this moment when you'll see in the ceremony where you bring the wisdom from your head and put it in the water, and you know, nah, 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 and then you do this and whatever, and then at one point after you've done that, you have to return the wisdom to your head. You bring it back to your head. And I screwed that up. She said she did the same thing. You know, and it's a lot to integrate, a lot of stuff you have to do. But after that, I also followed, you know, my teacher's advice was that it's not you doing it. And she said that maybe Maizumi Roshi told her to do, or someone. I think it was Maizumi Roshi who told her to do it. Call the lineage to help. Mm. Summon all of the ancestors. That's what's doing it. It's not you. Because as long as you're attached to, like, I'm doing it, you know, then I'm, like, super attached to, I'm going to make a mistake. And I'm not doing this right, or I have to do this right. Or it's not about me. Mm. Not about me. And that's essential to remember that. And
you didn't cry because it's so moving.
Well, because it's not me,
well,
you know.
Also, you know, so you have a lot to do.
Yeah, I know. I did used to cry when Gen Roshi was giving Jukai, every time for years I cried. It was so moving. My own Jukai, I had never seen a Jukai before, ever. Had no idea what I was getting into. And I just was like sobbing practically through the whole ceremony. You see the pictures and you see this woman like sobbing, you know, crying. But it was just so emotional, so moving. So yeah.
You're in trouble.
Bring out the tissues.
Although, yeah, but everybody experiences it differently though, you know. Oh, I know what I was going to say about the mistakes was that Gen Roshi first time gave Jukai to 7 of us. And Genpo Roshi was there, of course. He was not there when she was writing on the rakusus. And so we all have our black rakusus. Unfortunately, my cloth ripped and fell apart. So I have a separate thing that I had to sew in and she wrote something else on it. So I don't have the proof, but my Dharma brothers and sisters have the proof that she misspelled Tathagata on all of our rakusus.
No.
Yes. So this has become legendary. She forgot the H.
About the H.
Well, we won't tell you what you misspelled.
So probably I did. So every time I write Tathagata, I'm thinking, wait a minute, then I have to look it up. Am I spelling it right?
No, it's something else.
What is it?
There's a word missing, and I'm
on yours.
On mine, and several other.
What is it? Several other words.
I can't remember.
So let's hear it now.
Yeah, I can't remember what it is because when I saw it, somebody said, "Oh, me too." Passes through liberation. A formless
field.
Benefaction. There's no
field.
Yeah.
Oh, it just says a formless benefaction.
A formless of benefaction.
Oh.
I wear the Tathagata looks pretty good for me.
Probably is. Probably, I looked it up, yeah.
Tathagata teaching.
But I forgot field.
I have field.
You forgot.
What?
I have field.
You have field?
It's really formless.
It really is formless. Not even a field.
It's so formless we don't want to even mix the letters.
Is somebody else? Is it missing on yours too? Field?
It's in French.
Oh, it's in French. Is it missing?
I don't think so.
Somebody else, I remember saying, looking, finding this, and somebody, Portuguese person said, oh, me too.
Okay.
I don't think it's the same word.
So it's a, you know, collector's item, right? Unique.
My requisite, of course it is.
That's right, Debbie's requisite, she made it, gave it to me, and it was stolen.
Mine is
so complete. She had to make it again. Yours is fine?
Mine is complete.
Some people have all the luck.
No, yours is complete too.
Absolutely.
Okay, so maybe we should stop so that we can help. Yes, let's do the four rocks.